Hello and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. And it's wonderful to be back with you for another deep dive into a prime David Bowie album. And this one is an especially intriguing one. Retrospectively, The Next Day from 2013 has been somewhat overshadowed in the canon by the circumstances and the dizzying creative vision of Black Star that followed 3 years later. But when The Next Day was released a decade ago in March 2013, after that surprise drop of the Where Are We Now single in January, 2 years of intermittent secret recording sessions had resulted in a really substantial body of music and lyrics. The music had moved ahead from Greality's chunky sonic textures a year before, but here we have a far sharper, darker, more cynical lyrical lexicon. And that's ironic, because as you'll hear in this episode, from a clip where Tilda Swinton is talking about her appearance in the Stars Are Out Tonight video, Bowie was an incredibly happy presence in a really, really good place. So, by all accounts, actually, his private life was serene and happy at this point, but still, here, he employs a number of voices to address purple-headed priests, bodies left to rot in hollow trees, mass shootings, nihilism, warfare, celebrity culture, gangs, guns, Berlin, mental turmoil, and a jungle on Nürnberger Strasse. And that's only side one. The whole album clocks in at 53 minutes, and each one of those minutes relays scads of detailed data requiring close attention. So, I thought, who better to analyse and reflect on this richly textured tapestry of words and music than Lear Cardos, the musician, professor, leader of the Stylophone Orchestra, co-founder of the Visconti Studio at Kingston University, composer of the music that you can hear right now, and author of the superb book Black Star Theory, The Last Works of David Bowie. And some of you will remember Lear from the conversation that she did with me with Donny McCaslin over a year ago now, when we spoke to Donny about his memories of working with Bowie on Black Star. Some of that conversation actually ended up being quoted in Black Star Theory, so it definitely was well over a year ago. But the book covers Bowie's final projects, starting with The Next Day. And so in this episode, I begin by asking her why she chose to begin her book at that point. So come and join us, and I hope you enjoy this conversation.
First of all, I couldn't talk about Black Star without talking about Lazarus the Musical, because that really, if you look at it, Lazarus the Musical in the chronology is actually the last thing that he worked on. And so, yeah. You know, and he was really, really sick. And so if there was ever a parting gift, you know, I'll see you later, I feel like I'm going soon type project, then it would be Lazarus. And certainly it holds up to that viewpoint if you want. But then I thought, you can't talk about Lazarus without talking about The Next Day, because there's a character in Lazarus, Valentine, that only sings The Next Day song.
Yes.
And then you look at The Next Day and you think, well, this is also something that's happening to Bowie in this very last phase where he's not there. He is there in this deconstructed form, just like the V&A exhibition. So you look at the artwork, yeah, and he's not there. You look at the songs and they're very emotional, very dark. And the idea of him is sewn through, scattered through, but David Jones isn't there. So this idea of Bowie, it becomes remystified. And I really caught on to that idea of, you know, he stopped doing interviews. We didn't see him anymore. When he spoke to us, it was in weird codes, you know, weird lists. His image isn't there. It's upside down. It's hidden. It's hidden behind a white thing, you know. And it's like, well, where is Bowie? And then you get the David Bowie is. Well, he's everywhere. He's everything. He's in you. And it's like, okay, that's weird. And then, you know, so I really thought that those last 3 years have a momentum to them and there's a coherence there. And I really wanted to sort of look at it. And I had lots of trouble with The Next Day. So when I came to the book, I just thought this would be a great chance for me to re-engage with this album, this huge, big piece that I found quite daunting. And at the time when it came out, my head was spinning because the storyline was Bowie's back and there's a video, he's singing about Berlin and oh my gosh. And then the new album's out, there's like new videos all the time and there's an extra special box set. And the storyline was never really about the nature of the project so much as it was, you know, Bowie's back and he's not talking. And isn't this weird? And then, of course, you know, everything came thick and fast after that. We had Lazarus and we had all the Black Star videos. And so we head spinning at the end of all of that. But actually, if you go back and look at the next day, it's really interesting. And so I had to go back and have a look at it again.
Having read the book, I know there's an awful lot to talk about. And I would definitely urge people, if they haven't already got a copy of the book, to make sure that it's on their bookshelves ASAP, because it is very well worth having. But that's why I asked you onto the podcast, is to talk about the next day. And like you said just then, it's the first kind of silent Bowie album, in the sense that it was preceded by silence. I think Where Are We Now dropped, what was it, January 2013?
Today is David Bowie's 66th birthday, but it's his fans who've been given the present. After 10 years of virtual silence, the legendary rocker has released a brand new single. It's called Where Are We Now, and it's got critics purring in delight.
Welcome back. David Bowie is the latest singer to announce a comeback.
About in this song. And that's one of the interesting things. It's produced by Tony Visconti, who was the producer of Bowie's classic Berlin albums at the end of the 70s, The Lodger, Low, Heroes.
He revealed his new single called Where Are We Now on his official website earlier this morning, giving his fans a welcome surprise after a 10-year break. Well, our arts and entertainment correspondent, Lucy
I think
Costa,
I'm right in saying that he was probably the first major artist of the decade and probably of the 2000s to drop an album like this without pretty much any advance notice. I mean, there was no round of TV chat shows. Do you remember when he was promoting Heathen and Reality and he was there with Michael Parkinson or Jonathan Ross?
Yes.
And
yes,
he was matey and chummy and gregarious and, you know, just
relaxed. Oh, I love that era.
I know. That was the Bowie-net
era.
He's
actually really forthcoming in those interviews. I mean, this is, sorry, off topic, but like recently I went back and looked at all of those again because I've been writing about Bowie and classical music, and he mentions it a bit in that Parkinson episode, that particular interview where he sat next to Tom Hanks.
Yes, yes.
But going through there, there's so many times where he's just so candid about his creative process and about his whole career perspective. And, you know, there's this sort of late era Bowie that's just, yeah, ask me anything, I'll tell you, you know, and like literally lifting the lid on decades long mysteries about his music. And it's a goldmine. And there's so many more. Like after Bowie died in 2016, I think CBS and a few other news outlets unearthed, you know, little snippets of interviews that never got aired. And it's amazing. You just think, wow, we really were, you know, suffering with no Bowie oxygen in the last period. He said nothing. He was saying everything in 2001, 2002. Just amazing.
No. Let's start with it now. Probably the tuba.
Well, that one. There's this weird bit. Don't forget that. It was that note.
Yeah.
It was like awkward, you know.
Extraordinary beginning to where you got to, into some rock and roll. And
yeah, well, I like Little Richard along with this stuff.
But you mentioned that when you saw Little Richard, you mentioned an interesting word, rebellion.
Yeah.
I mean, what was the purpose of your rebellion? What was it?
Oh, I don't think I really ever had a rebellion.
Well, you could.
No. Only against my mother and father, really. It was really no wider than that. You know, it wasn't against the world generally. I wanted to get a lot of the world. I wanted as much as I could get. So,
well, what was wrong with your mum and dad?
They fuck you up, your mum and dad.
That's what Larky says. But do you believe that to be true?
With my mother, yeah.
So do you think perhaps after the health problems that followed the Reality tour, after his sort of seclusion, do you think, well, really, you know, what's there left to say? You know, what do I go back out onto the chat shows now, or do I focus on getting the album done? I mean, the album did take a long time, didn't it?
Yeah.
From its initial seeds. So just kind of talk us through how it began to take shape.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe he said everything he needed to say in the reality tour junket.
How many more Mick Jagger imitations can I do, really?
Exactly. How many times can you put the sunglasses on and wiggle them around? And, you know, yeah, maybe that's the case. But I think as well, perhaps, you know, what happened in the intervening time was this really bizarre mutation of celebrity culture emerged in the wake of reality TV and this sort of access to celebrities, paparazzi culture. You know, I think maybe also having a young child might have just made him want to preserve his privacy even more. But there's also currency in having privacy. You know, there's fascination. I think that fuels some kind of hunger in the fandom for stuff. You know, it keeps people wanting more. And, you know, dropping the single out of nowhere, I mean, that's been cited in music press a number of places as being quite revolutionary, and a lot of artists since then, particularly at the highest echelons of pop music, have copied that move, just out of nowhere dropping whole albums onto the internet at midnight and then watching the place just burn up with excitement. I think Beyoncé did it with her self-titled and with Lemonade, and then her husband Jay-Z did it with his next album. I think Taylor Swift's done it with a couple of albums recently as well. So I think because of the internet and because of the way that music was consumed changed, but we could actually just come back like that, and how classy and how, you know, just how amazing to not say anything, not tease it, nothing, just drop it and just see what happens. And but yeah, you know, so going back to your question, from what I could sniff out from all of the press, which was the press around the next day, is literally everyone involved in the next day. As soon as their, NDAs expired, they could finally talk about it, because Bowie didn't say anything, but everyone else did. But, you know, sniffing around that, there was this sense that Bowie was testing the project for a long time. So from November 2010 up until it came out in 2013 and even beyond, he was still recording stuff for the rest of the project, vocals for the Next Day Extra and little bits and pieces. So there were still sessions in the summer, I think August, maybe even September 2013, after it had been out, you know, it was crazy. So all of that stuff in the background suggests some kind of careful project planning. And the story that the people in the bands were saying and Tony was saying is that it was never called an album, right? It was just a project or an experiment up until the moment when it was obviously an album, and then he couldn't hide that it was an album. But I spoke to Tony about it, and the words that he used were lack of confidence. There was this feeling like, you know, not sure if this is what it is. I'm just dipping my toe back into music. There's no commitment. You know, at this point, he's on Isola. He's got ISO. You know, he's got his own label. There's no pressure. So he can do what he wants. And so I think the long drawn out, you know, process of this album being in the oven is maybe partly to do with building up a confidence and just getting back into the habit of being creative. But also I feel like there might be something bigger going on in the background, a story that maybe we're not meant to know about a failed musical that was, you know, worked on and then not worked on. There's that story by Michael Cunningham and GQ and other little whispers around the place that, you know, he had projects that were mooted to happen and then didn't happen for whatever reason, ill health or circumstance. So I feel like there was a glut of material just sort of hanging around, music that he'd been making, and he wanted to try and make something out of it. And it became The Next Day. And the way The Next Day is, and the way that it's fashioned, either has to be, in my mind, either has to be by design, as in I'm going to do this sprawling project where all of these songs are going to be separate characters, possibly inspired by literature, but also drawing from my myth and blurring the lines between them. But they're all going to be very strong. So really strong flavors, archetypal, you know, movements, lots of murder, lots of, you know, pitied people, lots of tragic cases, lots of incels, lots of stuff like this. Whether that was the point or whether he just had a grab bag of stuff and the framing of like, well, you tell me what it is. You make sense of it, and putting the white thing on the top and saying, look, what do you make of it? Could have been like a really clever artsy way of framing it in a way that lets him get away with it being a grab bag of songs. I think it's one or the other, either a grand plan or a sneaky, you know, get away with it little plan.
Is your gut feeling that he had more or less been on creative hiatus then? This came then as a very definite strategy that to focus on these particular themes, to have a certain degree of intellectual rigor and real focus, determination.
My gut feeling, I don't want to speak out of turn. I don't want to seem like I've researched this and I'm telling you the truth. This is just my gut feeling. But I think that he had been poking around with music on and off for the decade. And I feel like perhaps periods of ill health or what have you might have stopped him from making anything come of it. I believe pretty much Michael Cunningham's account, which places a musical with songs being written and developed for it around 2008, 2009, which fits in the chronology of things that we are and aren't supposed to know about. So, yeah, I feel like he was tiptoeing around in his recovery, in his convalescence. He was working on things, but perhaps not enjoying the music. We can think about, you know, She Can Do That. It's not that inspired, is it? You know, but he's still appearing with Arcade Fire and things like that. I mean, I've looked at this decade and, yeah, if he starts working in 2008, 2009 on a musical, if he in 2005 purchases the rights to the story from Walter Tevis's estate, then to me it speaks of, you know, still has is toe in the water creatively, still has plans in the works. And my gut feeling is that he really wanted to work on a musical throughout that time.
A musical was something that he'd mentioned on and off throughout his professional career, wasn't it? I think even in the 60s, there are interviews when he is saying he would love to do a musical, which kind of continues throughout the 70s, his failed attempts to do 1984 and so on.
The Ziggy musical, yeah, 1984. The comments to press, I'm going to, you know, give up rock and roll, I'm going to do the theatre, all that stuff. But also the Diamond Dogs tour, but also Glass Spider tour, but also the opera for One Outside that was going to happen. And also this sort of Ziggy musical in the late 90s, early noughties, that was supposed to happen. It seems like, you know, just every time he, you know, wants to achieve this, I don't want to use the word bucket list, this thing that he wants to do, you know, his dream to make a musical, it just doesn't happen, doesn't materialize. And I was digging around, just looking at articles that came out about him in the quiet period when he was away convalescing. And there's a really interesting story. Oh, I don't have the actual reference in front of me, but it's a story about New York in the early noughties and how Robert Fox was sort of interviewed about something. And he just let slip, you know, that he'd been trying to hook Bowie up with playwrights from as early as 2005. So that would have been just after he was recovering from his heart attack. So the idea that, you know, these guys are having lunch together and talking about a musical that's ostensibly based on The Man Who Fell to Earth, that sort of, you know, scans pretty good for me based on, you know, my impression of that period. And so I think
it makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. And also I think it's possible that some of the songs that appear on the next day could be songs that were meant for some of those projects that didn't come through. That said, some of the songs date back as far back as 1979. So we know he hangs on to demos and he has vaults full of old scraps of songs. We know that. So maybe that theory gets blown out the water when we think some of these songs could come from literally anywhere in the timeline.
I was going to ask you this because I remember reading an interview with Zachary Alford, and he said specifically what you just said now, which is that he remembers there being a song which was dated from 79. Do you know what song that ended up being?
So I think Zachary says in that interview that it was Born in a UFO, which does sound quite sort of post-punky in a kind of,
it fits, doesn't it?
Yeah, in a Blondie sort of way. You can kind of hear that working there. No, not Blondie, B-52s. It's got a B-52s vibe to it. Which
wasn't he touring with the B-52s?
Yeah, around that time. Maybe he ripped it off or something.
So the next day, so we were talking about the incredibly long lead into this. I mean, 3 years, pretty much 2010 into 2013.
Yeah.
And
I think it wins the award as the longest cake in the oven for Bowie in terms of an album.
I guess so.
That he's working on.
I guess so. I mean, I can't think of any other Bowie album that had such a long gestation period. I really don't think there was. But you said a really interesting thing now about Tony saying confidence was a factor here. Mm. And that's something that's also, when you consider the strident, dark tone and a lot of the lyrical content here,
yes,
you know, you wouldn't imagine Bowie going, oh my God, am I going to do this? Is this the right thing now?
Yeah, I can see a crisis of confidence being, it's like, wow, this is pretty hard hitting. I've been away for so long. But also there are other interesting details about it, which compelled me to like look a bit closer. There was an interview somewhere, maybe it was Jerry Leonard, who said, you know, that the phone went dead for months on end and he just thought, oh, he's not liking the stuff, you know, fair enough, it's fine, it's over. But then he'd be surprised and, you know, months and months down the track, he'd get another call and, do you want to come and do some more work on it? And similarly, Tony, or I think it was Tony, said that, you know, he spent months, he went away for months just tinkering with the track order, the placement from track to track. And then that sort of made me as a musicologist go, well, that's interesting. If you spent months looking at that, then I need to have a look at it too and look at what song leads on to what next song. And you know, I think in those details that have emerged about his creativity and how careful and slow it was during that process kind of then leads me as a music analyst to look at those choices as being much more deliberate. Well, then everything is positioned just so. And this song is sat between these two, and that was a choice, you know. And then you think, well, all of this is a choice. That choice to evoke the past, that choice for Tony and David to quote Boys Keep Swinging at the end of How Does the Grass Grow, that's a choice. And so what does that then do? And I think when that clicked for me, when I didn't just experience it as music at face value, but looked at all the choices and how those choices speak to each other and how they energize a piece of work by being there and being odd or being incongruous or being resonant, really opened the album up for me. And so it started to make this much more sense as like a tapestry or something really carefully put together. And I feel like that's the creativity, you know, some Bowie albums are slapped together and they've got the magic of that. They're like a Damien Hirst drip painting and they just fall where they fall and it's beautiful. And then there's this album, which is one of the other type, which is, you know, really finely crafted, really thought about, sweated over. All those details are significant. And that's, you know, I think that really helped me penetrate the album and enjoy it more once you realise how all of that stuff's gone into it. Yeah.
So out of Bowie's albums, it would be true to say that not all of them had been considered in this much depth. I mean, you say some were slapped together. And that strikes me as a really interesting observation, because I would have thought somebody like Bowie would have always taken great care in assembling his album, you know, the running order, the way the tracks sit in juxtaposition to each other. But that's not necessarily the case always. No?
Well, I mean, it's just an impression that I have, right, that statement doesn't come with, you know, any kind of musicological certification. but I'm thinking more about just work that happens quickly versus work that happens very slowly, where the quick work of, say, some of the sessions that include, you know, improvisation and on-the-spot creativity, like maybe that you might hear in Heroes, for example, in those Hanser sessions, or even with like Tin Machine or even Station to Station, which that happened across just a two-week period, you know, where things are sort of thrown together and there's a group of musicians who are in the room responding and ideas are thrown out or games are thrown out, you know, and people respond and you capture the magic on tape and there it is, there's the hit. Compared to, you know, I'm going to spend a few months dealing with this recording that we made and then maybe I'll call Jerry back to do some overdubs 6 months later and we'll keep threading on top of this piece of work. And then he went away and did vocals and took a long time with that too. And, you know, that's really not how other albums in Bowie's past have been put together. And it's just that kind of that, I guess, what the intuitive gut kind of chemistry experiment of chucking all these dudes in a studio with a bunch of really solid demos versus this multi-layered polished egg that the next day is. And then, you know, that, and then that, I think that intentionality, as I said before, makes me zero in on the really weird details. Like, you know, at the end of a song when it just has that, I think at the end of If You Can See Me, that oceanic little sound design, you're like, well, why is that there? They spent time on that. Or the space radar guitar bit at the beginning of Informer that doesn't really work with the song. It's like a separate little statement at the start. Those details, you know, become more fascinating to me because they're not on the fly. They're not just accidents. They're very deliberate.
Okay, well, let's get started then with The Next Day. It's in the tradition of It's No Game, Beauty and the Beast, one of those songs that just leaps out at you and grabs you around the throat. What's going on here? There's so much happening. There's this incredibly dark narrative.
Oh, I loved this. As soon as I heard it, I was, you know, I was like most Bowie fans, I was like Easter egg hunting. I was like, oh, that sounds a bit Fripp. Oh, I think I can hear the harmonizer on the snare. Okay. He's yelping. That sounds very 1978. I was very like
there's
trying to
place. There's a lot of yelping, isn't there? Yeah. That's
trying to place all the references. Yeah. The strangled voice, that heightened excitement. That's a young Bowie voice. Really hard for him to execute in older age.
Yeah.
And the drums production, the weird sort of Fripp mechanic sort of guitar, this sort of hurdy-gurdy guitar. I just was so excited by it. But then, of course, you know, once you get over that layer, and once you get over the, I didn't know if it's a joke or not, but, you know, here I am not quite dying. And you're like, oh, thank God. Yeah. It's, you know, he's like, he's sort of saying something really quite obvious. Coming back after Where Are We Now, which kind of felt like, you know, he's old and, oh, the past. And it's all quite sad.
And he's doing his quavery old man
he's
voice.
He's doing his
as
little
well.
Old man voice, his loneliest guy voice. And you're just like, oh, no, poor Bowie misses the
didn't
past.
Tony have to go into the media and say, look, you know, if you think that's how the rest of the album sounds, forget it. It's very, very upbeat.
Yeah,
it's very
I think
strong.
He felt compelled to be like, you know, the whole album's not like that, you know. And it wasn't. I was glad. I love Where Are We Now, by the way. But, like, you know, I'm just really glad. And he comes out of the gates roaring, you know, pumping with blood. And, you know, here I am not quite dying. You're like, listen, you know, all this lovely stuff. I just was so excited. But then, you know, once you get that out the way, there's layers to it, right? And then once you live with it for a bit, you're like, oh, gosh, what's this song about? What's this corpse in a tree? What's going on? Who are these whores? Who are these priests? You know, why has the priest got a purple head? What is going on? You know, and so you try and penetrate that level.
To break it down for me a little bit here. 10 years on, you know, with all your forensic research into this album, how do you sum up the narrative here? If there is a linear narrative to sum up.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, the narrative is what you make of it in sense of, I mean, particularly if you read Chris O'Leary on The Next Day, he's very good at finding possible literary references. And so when I read Chris on this period, I'm like, oh, right, yeah, you know what, he was reading lots of books. He was very bookish. There is the list of 100 books that you must read before you die that he published that year, which felt like a real big hint to be like, you know, if you want to understand me and my music, you should look at these books. It's like a big hint in that direction. I think Chris identifies a few like stories or myths or historical accounts. And also Tony also said the same hint at the same time. Like he was like, Bowie was reading big books about history and wars and all of this. I think, you know, Tony did a lot of interviews that year. It's quite fun to sift through them. I think every now and then he sort of says maybe a tiny little bit too much and then he backtracks in the next one. So it's quite good to look at all of that. But yeah, so I certainly think that there's definitely going to be threads hanging out of that song that take us back to some really interesting accounts, historical things, stories from the past, literature, which is, you know, I haven't looked into all of that. I've read other analyses and been like, that's super interesting and I love how all that connects. But musically, which is what I'm interested in, and partly because, you know, with my book, I was trying to offer something different. There's just so many people out there sort of looking at the lyrics. And so I sort of made a point of looking at the lyrics, but after I've looked at the production and the music first. And, you know, the music is just, to me, it's just such a statement of vitality. And the way that he's using his voice and the way that the music is pumping and the tempo at it, that it's pumping at, it's just super exciting, angry. And the music and the lyric is angry. The voice is angry and emotional. And yeah, and you know, and then you've got your three words: effigies, indulgences, and anarchist.
Okay, let's just back up a second here now because I forgot to bring this up. This is super important for anyone.
Oh, it is super important.
This is crucial. So I'm sure many of you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you don't know what I'm talking about, Leah, who was the writer? This was a writer who wrote to Bowie when the album came out. As a side note, I love it when you read about these stories and it says so and so just wrote to Bowie. Thinking, was it that easy just to sit down and write him a letter? I know. I mean,
maybe when you're Rick Moody, author of the Ice Storm. Maybe you
that
have.
That was it. Yes, yes. Rick
maybe
Moody.
You have an inside line. I don't know, because didn't Bowie do it? He did a song for the
there's
movie.
A, yes,
for the
yes.
Ice
there's
Storm?
Some link there. There's some link there, and I'm sure
it's very tenuous
I've,
link.
I've read that he was a fan of the Ice Storm. I'm actually going to look this up right now. Bowie, the Ice Storm, because Rick Moody was indeed the author.
Yes.
And so I'm sure it's not, if it just, you know, in another universe, if it had been Arslan Mohammed, the host of Album to Album, asking David Bowie for an interview, then I'm sure.
Help me understand your work.
I need to understand your work, The Ice Storm.
I think that was made into a movie with Sigourney Weaver or something. And
Kevin Klein.
And a song was used on it.
I Bowie can't song. Read.
Yeah, I can't read.
Yeah, it's the acoustic version. I love this version. Okay, well, you can find that on YouTube. But so Rick Moody wrote to David Bowie and said, "Dude,
what is it about? Like, basically, I think the words he used were, so I can get a grip on the lexicon. Album's lexicon.
Yes, yes,
lexicon being a really lovely word, and then Bowie responds to that with actual list of words." Which, and then in the piece that Rick Moody writes for, I think it's the Rumpus, this whole website, he writes this very long form piece just riffing off these words. He didn't know that structurally each of those three words links thematically to each song on that version of The Next Day, because there happened to be other versions of The Next Day.
Hang on a second. So he literally just got a list? It wasn't...
He just got the list. He didn't know.
To each song?
No. Oh. So in the piece, he's riffing on these words and he's really spinning some beautiful prose out of it. It's lovely. But it's not quite linking to the songs in this really specific way that has now become obvious now
right.
that we've seen
okay.
the list.
Because I have the list here in front of me. And so... For The Next Day, I have Effigies, Indulgences, Anarchist.
Yes. I don't know if it was officially endorsed by the Bowie people, by the, you know, that camp.
Yeah.
But it seems to be the accepted wisdom that everyone, no one's refuted, including people from the Bowie camp since then. So,
well,
and also...
Silence is a scent.
Well, yeah, exactly. I think everyone's just like, yes, that's what it is. And
okay, so maybe we'll go with that.
Maybe I missed the point where the official Bowie guys were like, yes, that's what it was. But yeah.
Well, we'll go with that then. We'll go with effigies,
we'll go with that.
Indulgences, Anarchist. Sorry, I interrupted you as you were talking about the musical.
Oh, no, just really. I mean, you know, you'll notice that I didn't choose to analyse this for my book.
So, I didn't want to bring that up. Just...
Yeah, so I don't sort of have, you know, anything to the calibre of what I offer for the other songs, except that, you know, I'm just looking through my notes here and just the fact that it's the emotion of the song. It just comes out the gate pounding and cranking and it's just so exciting. And it does feel a little bit glam, you know. It's got in the second chorus, it's got a little bit of, you know, a bit of Gene Genie, T-Rex.
Yeah.
It's got these sort of moments of this sort of sneering energy, which I really love. And yeah, I just think, you know, it's just a remarkable song. And I feel like what it does in terms of what it's bringing to the table is just this, you know, you thought I was sick, you thought I was feeble. Look, listen to that. Listen to this. And also listen, because I'm also singing about religious hypocrisy. That's one of my favourite subjects.
It's quite telling. It's quite telling when the singer repeatedly exhorts you to listen.
Yeah.
Which keeps popping up here throughout the song, listen. So, you know, you've got the body almost dying, rotting in a hollow tree. And all this gory imagery. And it does set the tone for the rest of the album. Do you think the album was named after this song for any special reason?
Well, just to backtrack a little bit, I think, yeah, the listen thing is really cool. I mean, one of the first things I thought of was Breaking Glass.
Mm.
You know, like,
listen,
don't look
yeah.
at the carpet, listen. But then, yes, I really like this thing of, like, you know, listening, because this album, more than any other, and it stands alone in the catalogue for being like this, is that it's full of self-reference sonically. And so, you know, Tony and David, Tony's talked about it a lot, how, you know, the only songs they were listening to at the time were their own productions together, and they're referencing their own sonic vernacular all the way through. And so when I hear the exhortation to listen, me, the musicologist, is going, yeah, I am listening. I'm hearing eventide effects on the drums. I'm hearing all of these callbacks. I'm hearing your voice. The way that you're voicing is a reference, and all the musical references piling up to create a really rich picture. But also listen to the lyrics, which are really unrelated to anything to do with Bowie's star story. You know, nothing, there's nothing about aliens really in this song. There's nothing about anything that could be construed to be linked to David Jones's life. So this is definitely a fictional character who's being persecuted, but who also has been assumed to be dead. And maybe the real Bowie is also assumed to be dead. And so he's not saying this is not me. He's sort of blurring everything together. He's taking something that's really quite obviously a fictional historical setting, but he's also blurring it with the facts and fictions of his stardom and his life and what we know of it. And that, to me, feels like the running theme and the coherent theme that runs through this album. This idea of, like, you know, I'm going to present you with some really troubling imagery and some really intense emotions and some unlovable characters who are very flawed, but I'm also going to blur all of that with my myth and also my sound worlds. And I'm not going to have an image for you to project any of this on. It's going to be a blank space and you have to construct it. And that's how I feel about this song. Again, you know what I said before, there's no nailing down anything in this period. You know, you can't just bang, this is what the song's about. That kills the song. What's much more effective is to look at the complexity of what the songs bring in into the frame and just going, well, that is really interesting. And that works against that, and that works against that. And he chose all of that to be there. And isn't that interesting, you know? So I can't, you know, really analyze it any more than that, except to say that there's just some really interesting things going on in this picture and a really interesting energy to come out with your first track on your comeback album.
And that's absolutely intriguing that you say that David and Tony were listening a lot to their previous work when they were putting this together. And we can pull out so much in there. Like you mentioned Fripp earlier, there's definitely that Fripp feel to it. I always think of Beauty and the Beast when I hear The Next Day.
The title track.
There just seems to be, I don't know if it's the positioning at the top of the album, the strident tone, the dark lyrical themes, but certainly there's some sort of resonance here for me with Beauty and the Beast. And the way that comes roaring in.
Definitely. I feel like there's a real strong Berlin sound to the production. And that's through the thickening of the drum production, but also the grinding distortions of the guitars and the way that they're mixed. I'm just trying to find the actual quote. I think it was Hollywood Reporter where Tony said they were listening just to themselves. They were just listening to their own music.
This is, we should just have a quick word about the personnel. So this is Jerry Leonard. Or Slick, because I know Earl Slick came back for this album.
Yeah, Slick came back. Jerry Leonard came back. I'm not sure who's on this one. I think it's Jerry, right? Sounds like Jerry. Mm. I need to check. Yeah. Hold up, I have the notes right here. I've got this thing here. Really hard to read, by the way, because it's all just text, all next to each other. I'm pretty sure it's Jerry. It's got to be. Oh, yeah, David Torn, of course, yes.
Let me hit you up with Violence, Chthonic, Intimidation. Yes, it's Dirty Boys.
Dirty Boys, yes.
A big, lumbering, honking, dark, shadowy thing, Dirty
Boys.
Yeah,
it's a Lazarus song as well. It's to me, it's got a bit of like West Side Story when you're a jet. It feels a bit like, you know, we're the Dirty Boys and they come in with their cricket bats and do a dancing routine or something with the saxophone solo.
But just
as well.
A lot more shadowy and lurky. That sax, what's going on with the sax there? It sounds like it's been recorded in a garage or something just outside the studio.
It's kind of nasty, isn't it? But that's Steve Elson from the Borneo Horns, which is like everyone who came in on this record is like, you know, either really local or really like trusted from decades ago. So like so it's nice having, you know, a flavor of tonight back for the Dirty Boys, dancing with the big boys and Dirty Boys. I would like to see his little sheet. Yeah, you know, if you go through Bowie's his little passions. He quite likes well-dressed gangsters. And I think go back to like the Droogs and the fashions from A Clockwork Orange that influenced the Spiders. But then immediately after the Spiders, he goes on to this sort of Chicago gangster look with the big wide leg trousers. And he's got the the Gouster, and the whole song around the Gouster, you know, is about a woman with razor blades in her bra, and, you know, the Gouster's this really fashionable criminal. But then fast forward to, you know, Glass Spider, and they're all kind of dystopian but fashion criminal gang. And then you get to, like, Dirty Boys, and knowing that you know, but Bowie, the still, you know, with the bisexual eye, quite interested in, you know, Cillian Murphy and Peaky Blinders. You know, that was his favourite show.
Of course, he was a big fan.
Huge fan. And around this time, he, like, you know, was emailing the production company and offering music to them and taking pictures of himself in a Peaky Blinders style hat, and then Cillian, like, sending him one from the production show. And yeah, a super fan.
He was a real fanboy. He was super a real fanboy, fan. Wasn't he?
But the idea of, you know, Dirty Boys, this sort of sinky, sexy, slinky thing with the cricket bats and stuff, to me just feels like along that long line of, you know, Bowie being, you know, bisexually pervy to dangerous Dirty Boys. And I didn't even mention Tin Machine, the way they presented themselves like a mafia group, you know.
Well, of course, yeah.
Yeah, so I see that there, but also know that he was really binge-watching Peaky Blinders at the time, season one. This feels like a Peaky Blinders type song to me.
There's definitely got that swagger you just mentioned straight off, West Side Story.
Yeah.
And
but also, know, a bit, also a bit of that Nick Cave type, you know, whatever that Red Right Hand song that is at the start. It's got a bit of that sort of nasty swagger to it too.
Definitely got the nasty swagger. Is there anything about the composition here that strikes you as being unusual or especially worthy of comment?
I really just enjoy, just on the level of songwriting, I just enjoy the chorus, you know, when the sun goes down and the dye is cast, the whole overlapping lines leading up, the harmony change there. It's just so refreshing and just really well done. I just think it's just someone who knows how to put a song together.
It's true, isn't it? The structure allows these sort of euphoric release moments.
Yeah.
And then you go back to this rather dank cellar where the sax solo lives.
Yes.
And it's all very dark and damp and dripping. You know, I love this contrast between the two. It works really, really effectively here.
Yeah, I just think, I just see it as just a classy songwriter. This is a guy who's been writing songs for decades, knows what he's doing. It's just a lovely moment. And you're right, it's a palate cleanser between the just incredibly dank nastiness of this sort of stomp, this sort of tethered, this sort of, you know, it can't, it's a flightless, it's this groove that just doesn't lift off. But then in the chorus,
that's a brilliant
does,
description, you know? Vampiric Pantheon Succubus.
I love this song. This song has grown on me. I remember not really digging it when it came out.
Yeah.
But it's the one that, like, when I listen to this album now, it's like, oh, yeah, I love this. It's one of those growers.
You know, it's funny you say that, yeah. I read an interview with Trent Reznor where he said the same thing. He said for the first year this album was out, he thought it was pretty conservative. And then when he returned to it, as he returned to it, it just got more and more and more rewarding. And I know what you mean. I think because there was a big media presence for this song. You know, you had the Floria Sigismundi video and there was a lot of hoo-ha about the, you know, Tilda Swinton's in it. And, you know, it's very glam. And, of course, it's like Bowie takes on Hello Magazine culture. And so I think the deceptive simplicity of this one meant you could quite happily skip over this to Love Is Lost.
Yeah.
But let's just have a look at
this one. Let's indulge ourselves for a second.
You're saying it's one of your favourites.
Yeah, it really has emerged as one of my favourites. I mean, just really just thinking now, just all the things that I love about it. I just really love its movement. It glides and slides and it's got this lovely fluidity to this string arrangement. It's like this beautifully gilded strings. The bass line keeps it rolling through. The melody line is just wonderful. I really love that bling, bling, the sort of glint that comes through it.
Yes.
So on a basic, you know, basic level of all the nuts and bolts that makes it up, things that annoyed me about it to begin with, I really love about it now because it's, for whatever reason, it hangs together and grows and sort of, you know, gels better the more I listen to it.
So you initially found that little kind of glinting motif a little bit grating.
Yeah, I think when I first heard it, I just thought, well, this is nothing new. Come on. You know, I felt a bit like it just sounded like an old reality song to me. And similarly, I had similar feelings about Valentine's Day, to be fair. I was like, come on, this sounds, you know, 15 years
it's
old.
It's interesting you say reality. This could easily have sat in reality, couldn't it?
Yeah, and I think I was, at the time, I was hungry for something new, you know. So I think that's what coloured my experience. But going back to it, it's just so well crafted and so well executed. And it's just really, really, really nicely done. And I love his vocal on it. And then, obviously, you know, I really appreciate in retrospect how he rearticulated the star myths ahead of Black Star. I think that's really important. This song, what this song does, you know, it sort of says there are stars and then there are stars. And the stars I'm talking about are the, you know, the blood-sucking vampires of capitalism, and they need you. They need the oxygen that you give, and actually you need them because they are your role models, and, you know, they're useless, they're unaroused, they do nothing for you except haunt you and make you feel bad, but actually we hope they live forever because these are our myths, you know. And that's this really beautiful thing, and that what that does is that sets up beautifully Black Star and the idea and the iconography of it, as well as calling to mind, you know, Bowie's long, very detailed history of stars and all the different kinds of stars that can exist. And, you know, you've got your bright failing stars and your prettiest stars and all the other stars, rock and roll stars. And then you've got these stars, and then you've got your Black Star. And I just really appreciate the effort that he went to rearticulate that arc at the end of his career. Not only because it makes my book hold together, but because I think it's just really nice to draw those 50-year-long...
Thanks, David.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. But also, you know, to draw those lovely long threads and to complete them. What an honour, what a thing to do. You know, I just love that.
He pinpoints this dissonance between we need these stars and we hope these stars will last forever, and the emptiness of it as well. Somebody who's been a star, somebody who, you know, is perceived as a star, talking about this and reflecting on this and this completely messed up relationship that we have. And also it feeds into his endless ongoing quest for a god, or what fills the god space, the god void in our lives. There's certainly some degree of that. I think it's such a fascinating thing to
definitely
also then mull in the star lineage that goes through his career. You quote people in the book
who, for sure, yeah,
you know, scientifically underline the fact that we are stars. You know, we are all stars. This is a theme that has come up quite a few times that you address in the book.
Yeah, there's so many star connections that have emerged from science, but also from myth, also from, you know, 21st century discourses around stardom and what it means and how problematic it is, fame, etc., iconicity. But also just, you know, what we know about photons, which is light particles, how they are pretty much, science says, you know, immortal, in the sense that hardly any of them, if any, have decayed since the Big Bang, is kind of what it does. Is it allows us to have a new myth, you know, it allows us to build another thing that is metaphysical, but it's grounded in some kind of truth that we can hang on to, that gives us hope beyond death. And so all of that is just like, in this space and time in history, you know, we have access to this information. But also we have this idea of late stars, you know, becoming these red giants, which isn't, I mean, I know I'm getting into the book now, but like, this is something that Chris O'Leary writes about when he's talking about heat. And he just mentions offhand that, you know, Scott Walker in his late career was like a red giant, you know, how red giants and then when a star just swells up and just consumes, swells up and knocks the mic. No, it swells up and just consumes everything they have accumulated and just grows and grows and grows until they disperse. You know, they don't need anything. They just have everything. And it's this last big thing. And if they're big enough, they become, you know, a black hole, a singularity. And that just really led me to this idea of late stars, how they can create this kind of discourse with themselves and with their own pasts, and kind of just, you know, metabolize themselves, cannibalize themselves. And it just, again, just made me think, you know, what Bowie does on the next day is a little bit like that too. You know, becoming this red giant, this, you know, this bigger star, end stage star, a star dying, but can possibly transform into something else, you know, even more exciting and mysterious. The Black Star, yeah.
And that definitely does resonate with these words, vampiric, pantheon and succubus. You know, those are all tangentially, I think there's some pleasing resonance there with these these theories that we're talking about, and certainly the self-consuming nature of the star in a very mundane human level.
Yeah, and also, you know, he'd obviously also been away from it for a decade. You know, him and Iman were celebrities at the top of the, you know, the pecking order in the late 90s and the early noughties, just as this weird celebrity culture was taking off and the internet got really invasive and all of that. So, you know, I'm sure Bowie was on the sidelines of all of that while he was in hiding and hiatus, watching it all with horror. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, about how stars have to give of themselves a level of, you know, non-privacy in order to, you know, have the oxygen of attention that allows them to have a career is also a thing that he might be indirectly commenting on based on, you know, the lack of access we had to him.
Absolutely. But then I think this is nothing new, is it? I mean, go back to 1975, Fame, you know, where it puts you there where things are hollow, you know, like a star collapsing in on itself. Even that long ago, there was a very coruscating takedown of Fame and the hollowness at the heart of it, which I see this as being a relation to. Definitely, this song is a cousin of that disillusion and of that bitterness.
Oh my gosh, striving. Yes. You almost blow my mind with that. Yes, Fame and the Stars Are Out Tonight. Yes, there's a connection there.
I met him on a street corner, actually, in London, in West London, and we just started talking, and then we met with some other friends, and anyway, we sort of knew each other a tiny little bit through the ether. And then I was actually on a rare holiday, and the phone rang, and it was David Bowie on the end of the phone. And he rang up and he said, "I got your number, and I want to make a. Do you want to be in the video for my new? I mean, can you believe this?
No,
it actually happened. And Floria Sigismondi, who's a great makes particularly beautiful music videos, shot this film, and I went to LA and we shot it there.
So
the stars are out tonight.
Were you friends with him by that point, or were you just acquaintances?
We were acquaintances, and I was of course a super fan who was pretending not to be a super fan like everybody else on the planet. But we were just very warm. We just had a very, very nice... He was a fan of Derek's, and he recognised me on the street corner. Can you believe it?
Is that how it happened? So he recognised you?
He recognised me. He said, "Tilda," and I went, "What?" And we started chatting, and then after we shot this, we became very close pals.
It is really, really good, and I just sit there watching it thinking, I can't imagine what a cool experience it must have been to do that.
Pretty cool.
Was he everything that you would have wanted him to be?
And more. The thing that I want to say about him, which I think is the most emblematic and important thing, is he was so happy. He was just a happy person. I mean, presumably he had moments when he wasn't as happy as when I knew him, but he was just so up for it and such a laugh. And yeah, this beautiful line in the film when I first go into the supermarket and we say, "We have a nice life." That's what we always used to say to each other. We used to sign our emails, "We have a nice life, we have a nice life."
There was a lovely quote in an interview with him in which he said, "You know, when I was young, I always thought that, you know, being a rock star, being married to a supermodel would be great. And it is."
Exactly. Exactly.
Hostage, Transference, Identity, aka Love Is Lost.
Love Is Lost. I mean, got to be one of the best songs of his latter day. One of the best songs he's done, but definitely of the late period for sure.
Yeah.
I just think it's so impressive.
This is such an extraordinary, it all comes together here now in this incredibly terrifying track.
It's really scary.
I mean, come on,
even
the three words are scary, right? Like Hostage, Transference, Identity. That's like a really dark Netflix series right there.
yeah. This is the one that just, I don't know, when I first listened to this album, I was like, oh, here we go. This is a classic.
Yeah.
This is good. Like, I just knew straight away. It's like, this is such a good song. I remember saying to someone on Twitter, a friend of mine, Annie, was saying on Twitter just how much she loves reality and, you know, counting all the ways how good it is. And I'm just like, listen, there's nothing on reality that's as good as Love Is Lost. End of argument. It's like, you can't talk to me. You can't talk to me about this.
And it's kind of funny you say that when we had the track, the preceding track felt quite reality in terms of construction and texture. You know, just now while we changed over, I was just thinking, yeah, you're right. You know, you've got that kind of careering acoustic all the way that's going through it. That to me seemed quite reality. But then we come here and bam. So, all right. So there's a lot to get through here. But the first thing I want to talk to you about here is, now you touched on this earlier, Tony and David listening back to their previous work. And here we have the harmonizer pitched drum effect on Love Is Lost. So tell us a little bit about this. What's happening here?
Yeah, so the Eventide harmonizer had this unit, the H910, which was one of the pieces of equipment that Tony took to the Low sessions and to Hansa Studios for some of the Hero sessions. And it's the bit of equipment that he famously said, you know, oh, it fucks with the fabric of time. Because it basically, what it let you do was pitch things without changing the duration or the speed of the things. So it's not like slowing down tape or anything like that. It just digitally takes the pitch without changing the duration. And they played around with it and experimented with it, with what it could do. What you can do is you can send the any sound to it and it will spit out a sound at a different pitch. But then you send more of that sound to it, you can create this sloping sort of drum sound, which, you know, to be fair, it's quite a weird sound. But it was really,
it's really weird.
It's really influential. You know, it was used on The Idiot with Tony. You know, Tony was helping Bowie when Bowie produced that album. And also, you know, was used way through the 80s with the post-punk guys. You know, if you hear that kind of fat, detuned snare with, you know, Duran Duran Rio, for example, or Girls on Film, you can hear that effect being used. But also not just there, but like, you know, Throb and Gristle were playing with it as well. You know, it was Grace Jones was playing with it. So the effect is, you know, had a really long life being quite influential. But the way they used it on Low is exactly how they use it on this song. It's really conspicuous because there's a drum break where the rest of the song just falls apart and the drums are highlighted and they turn that effect up.
Yes.
You know, it's like you can hear Bowie's little voice from track one going, listen to this.
It's really at a very climactic moment of the song, isn't it? When that break comes in and it's just dung, 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 dung,
dung,
and then the final climax comes in of the whole song.
But when that effect plays across the drum fill when it goes on the toms, it's so low. You can almost feel it in your bowels, like blah, 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 as it goes down. It's like such a satisfying sound. And yeah, it's doing something, isn't it? I mean, it's making you think back. It's making you thread a connection in your mind between time and space, which I think is the magic of this album. And what it does is it's like saying, okay, that's a sound from, you know, the Berlin period. And so then that brings that ghost to the table and you're like, okay, so the ghost of Bowie in Berlin's here. And the next song is also about Berlin and also the song about Love Is Lost. And you can start sort of piecing together the fragments of a narrative. You start, you know, I think in the lyric he mentions, you know, it's your darkest hour, you're 22, you know, you're on the edge of something, your voice is new. And you think, well, you know, in Bowie's star myth, that's just before he became famous, that's just when Hermione left him. And so you're pulling all this stuff together about lovelessness and, you know, this character who chooses something else over love and forever is being damaged by that and going through so much trauma because of it. And so, you know, I think that enriches what is quite a vague impressionistic story with those threads of connection. It's the drama that the connective threads bring to the table, which I find beautiful.
I love how he cherry picks from his past and thinks, right, this mood, this feel, this reference is what I need here on this story. So we're talking about this narrative of speaking to a character who is, you know, young, 22, who is eschewing love for, I don't know,
Something else.
But it's then what,
immigration doesn't work, changing their face doesn't work, having money, having a maid doesn't work, because they're reflecting John Lennon's thing of, you know, love is lost, lost is love, you know, love is real is love. It's bringing that into it as well.
And also reflecting, I mean, as you mentioned, the Plastic Ono Band album, it's also echoing when Lennon doesn't believe in the Beatles, he doesn't believe in Dylan, he doesn't believe in yoga, he doesn't believe in, you know, X, Y, and Z. You know, it's like all these things don't work. This is what, I just believe in me, Yoko and me, i.e. I just believe in love.
But I think as well, like there is also this lovely little I think in my mind, there's this little tiny little image of John and David and their parallel lives and their, you know, the way that David also links back to John quite often in his darkest hour, particularly like, you know, the definite conscious moments where he's referencing Plastic Ono Band album with, you know, 1979 with that version of Space Oddity, which just sounds like something from that album. And so there's these lovely connections to this sort of the tragedy of fame, right? The idea that, you know, if you choose something over love, you'll forever regret it and you'll find yourself at your lowest point. And when was Bowie's lowest point? You know, it was Low. You hear the drums from Low here. Even though it's not an invitation to connect everything and nail it down and go, well, this is a song about Bowie in the low period. But what it is this a group of ghosts all inhabiting this idea together.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it really lovely and enriching. And just the music is just so hard. You know, the guitar is just unrelentingly nasty.
It's a tough listen, isn't it?
The organ is sharp.
What is that organ? That single note that's just...
Yeah, so it's this sort of these fourths that he's playing in E-flat minor, but he's playing it on his little favourite keyboard, the Korg Trinity. It's a whole obsession of mine in the book. I'm so obsessed with this keyboard. He loved that dang keyboard. And, it pops up in some really strange places. But that sound is like a kind of church organ patch that he tweaked to make sound even more harsh, like say more high frequencies in there. And it's playing these fourths, which, you know, they're uncomfortable. They're not dissonant, but they're not consonant either. So you have this sort of, you know, it's like a sharp elbow digging you. You know, it's like this sort of, ugh. And it's very judgmental sounding as well, like just, you know, harsh light, you know, no bending, you know, absolutely just totally judgmental. And then so you put all of that together with these like barking dogs from, you know, Jerry Leonard's guitar that just snarl. Mm. And then as the song just goes on, there's these like breathing moments where it just does this little pulse, you know, you stop singing. And then it just like, you go, oh God, thank God. And then in the second half, after our little drum break, it's just relentless. It's just verse, 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 intensity, intensity, intensity. And all these voices from the background are coming up and they're really judgmental. They're like, you know, they're all around you. They start twisting into these like very speed voices, these sort of, you know, these twisted imagination voices that Bowie used to evoke every now and then, like at the end of the Bulle Brothers or, you know, during that moment in Scream Like a Baby when the character jumps into the furnace. And there's this sort of twisting of reality, this kind of, during a verse that's talking about therapy and just how useless it is. It's just like so dark.
At the end of it, you could almost hear you've got what you wanted. Now you're on your own.
Yeah.
London, but you know.
It's very like, you know, you made your bed type deal.
Yes.
But what I found really interesting was that, you know, it's evoking Berlin and it's this thing of knowing, you know, and that's a thing that comes up in Bowie's songwriting quite often, you know, the terror of knowing, you know, the idea that, you know, ignorance is great, but as soon as you know, it's over, you know, you can't come back from knowing. And so the idea of knowledge being a punishment in this song, you know, it doesn't matter, you know what happened, that you know is echoed in the next song, but framed differently, right?
Yes.
As knowledge that can help you be okay with things. You know, wait a minute, you know, and that's comforting. And it's echoing as well, I feel, like a statement that Dennis Potter says in his last interview with Melvin Bragg, where he says, you know, I can't tell you, you just have to know, and you only know you know when you know. It's what he says. This idea of there, but just in terms of how much Potter shows up with the Lazarus and with this sort of, you know, this idea of nowness. It was just nice and resonant for me to hear Potter saying the you know type, you know, circular thinking thing. And it reminded me of Where Are We Now? I don't know who, you know, where he got it from. Probably his, you know, he's been talking about knowing in his songs for decades, so maybe not. But it's a nice, pleasing resonance nonetheless.
Absolutely. Of course, you have this scarifying hellfire preacher at the end of Love is Lost, and then we move into the soothing, calm nostalgia of...
Well, interface, flitting.
Had to get the train from Potsdamer Platz. You never knew that I could do that. Just walking the day.
This idea of just of knowing, and I just said it before with the link to nowness.
Yeah.
This idea that you know, that no other moment actually exists, and Bowie's, you know, his song No Plan is, I feel like, a really genuine ode to nowness, in the sense that he talks about a life, the character of the song talks about life in terms of just the elements, the essence, you know, my moods. You know, my beliefs, that's what I am. And this idea of, you know, the only thing you know is what you know, and you only know it when you know it. Yeah. It's like this, it's almost like a weird sort of, you know, meditation prompt. But I feel in the last works, there's definitely a sense of just, you know, we're dealing with this now, and this is all we know, particularly with the chaos of Black Star. You know, there's a lot of like dealing with chaos and dealing with knowledge on Black Star. But here, it's hinting towards secrets as well, which I appreciate. It's you know, it's hinting towards knowledge, perhaps, of, I don't know, maybe he's learned something that he wishes he didn't know. It takes off with this heaviness, which at the time bothered me. And I remember talking to my mate Liz about the production on this song. No offense to Tony, it actually is a great production. But at the time, I was a bit frustrated about how it doesn't take off. You know, at the end, it's trying to, you know, it's sort of, you know, when he starts listing the elements, all the things that are important, you know, so long as there's sun, you know, as long as there's rain, me and you, just really elemental things. That's all that matters. But the music sort of tries to lift off like a really heavy plane. It doesn't quite get there. It's heavy striving. In my opinion, it just kind of dun, 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 it's just sort of like heavy pounding, really lifting up. It doesn't really float. It's banging on the door of something. And it used to bother me because I thought that's what the song needed to do. But of course, actually, I love it now more because it doesn't, because it is just banging on the door, you know, and it's like it's banging on the door of something. It's frustration to the song, which undercuts all of the kind of floatiness of the mood up to that point. And so now I think it's a masterpiece, you know, but at the time I would have, you know, said, nah, the production's all that great.
That's a great observation.
Those decisions are really good around this, you know.
I love the idea of like an overloaded heavy cargo plane. I mean, that's exactly spot on. That's exactly how it sounds. You know, you have this climax at the end and that piano motif repeating.
Pounding away.
But yeah. I love it. I mean, the sentimentality of the, as long as there's rain, as long as there's fire, you know, as long as there's you, you know, it is up there with Absolute Beginners, a track like that, where there
is this
gorgeous. Just, you know, it spills over into just sheer unadulterated romance. But how do you remember when you were listening to it on your first few hearings? Where did you anticipate that the payoff emerging?
I feel like I'm being heretical saying this, but when I heard it, when it's the comeback song, I remember going, oh, yeah. That's how I felt. I think I was just hungry for a big change, and I wanted, I think in my head, I was like, this has to be different. And it was different, but I remember feeling not disappointed, but just, you know, okay, you know, yeah, that's fine. It didn't set my world on fire musically at the time. But you know what did was when I saw the video.
Yes.
And then I realized there was a lot going on.
Yes.
That I was just not getting in my shallow reading of it, you know. And this remarkable image of a man being projected into a room for times three, but actually not being there. And everything that is in that image is just this, like, I think Tony Ursler calls it memory palace, right? This sort of pile of junk, which could be significant or not. But then you've also got the man in the corner watching this assemblage, and then you've got the man performing to the camera that's going to be projecting the man onto the face of the dummy, which is actually the dummy from his 50th birthday. Mm. And the lines of perspective and history that just, you know, intersect and tangle in that video, I just find delicious. And then you realize that the images of Berlin being projected behind him are modern day Berlin, not Berlin from the 70s. And you realize that there is a diamond on the ground, and there are images from that could be from his past or maybe not. And he's wearing the shirt.
Song of Norway,
And all of this stuff that you, I don't know, for me, it just, all of a sudden it made me realize in that moment that this is an artist that is using his past and his catalog as a palette of colors to paint with. And isn't that amazing? Like, isn't that meaningful? Like, you know, all of that beautiful baggage that he's got to play with, and he's just putting it all in front of you. And then I think when I saw the video and realized that that was the mode he was working in, I was on board. I thought, oh, yes, come on.
That was your way.
This is art. Yeah.
That was your way kind of around the deceptive
orderliness of the
composition. And I think you could throw in like the 7-inch sleeve cover, you know, the inverted 1974 image. I mean, that's not the sleeve of a gentle reflective ballad, isn't it? I mean, clearly you look I'm looking at it right now and remembering just how weird that was.
But I think it's like beyond it being quite chic and classy and simplistic in a really quite fashionable way. Like, well, that's really elegant, you know, just straight away. But I was talking to Jonathan Barnbrook about this, and he said it elsewhere as well. I actually found, like, when I interviewed him, I thought I was getting lots of really good bits. But then I've seen him talk in public a few times, and it's like he's saying the same stories to everyone. But anyway, he said that, you know, he was struggling with trying to find an image to use. He was struggling to find an image to use for the cover. And Bowie gave him this image from 1974. Mm. And with a little bit of context saying, you know, I felt incredibly alone and lonely in this picture. Maybe we can do something with it. And Jonathan goes on to try a few things, and he just can't do anything good with it. And then it was Bowie who said, let's turn it upside down. Jonathan said it took Bowie to do that to let me know that I have permission to play with his history. And again, this idea of using history, you know, playing with history, is what Tony and David are doing with the production on this album as well.
Exactly. It's what we were saying for the last track as well. They're going back and very carefully selecting sounds, textures, instruments, devices to very specifically summon a historical moment or feeling. And that's interesting what you say now about Jonathan as well, was that when David actually unlocked that key and gave him the permission to go there and to be inventive and to literally subvert that image, then that led on to this wonderful creative partnership. Because this was the first time they'd worked together, wasn't it, Jonathan?
So Jonathan was involved with Heathen.
With the
design. So not the photography, but the design of it. And also the package for Reality as well.
I see, okay.
So he's basically been a constant in the late period throughout.
But this is such a bold and radical statement, isn't it? Turning the picture upside down and then just asking, where are we now? Once we got there.
I think it's really elegant and really artistically, you know, deep. You can sit and probably write an essay about it, you know? Like, there's just so much going on in terms of the artist in conversation with himself, but also in conversation with an image that was not constructed for him, you know, by him, but the what fans think, you know. He's like, basically, I feel like all of this, you know, invitation for us to interpret who and what David Bowie is a natural extension to the V&A exhibition. This idea of, you know, well, what is Bowie and what does it mean? And if I evoke Berlin in these lyrics, what does that mean to you? And then how does that translate? This video, what does it mean if I put all of these images in the frame together? For some people, they might not see anything at all. For others, they might see everything.
And
I just think that's just a really lovely dimension to play with as an artist. And no, an artist can't do that unless they have, you know, decades and decades of work behind them.
I want to just have a quick chat about some of the people who are involved in this track. So this is a good time to talk about Henry Hay, who is the pianist. I believe this was the very first track that Henry played on for these sessions, was Where Are We Now. But who is Henry Hay? I mean, why? How did he and Bowie get to work together?
So Henry is he's such a lovely guy. He's like this New York stalwart musician, part of the scene, really active in the theatre and in like the live scene and the session scene in New York. So in terms of like how he got the gig, I think it was either through Tony or through someone in the studio who just knew a good pianist to get in. He had to do some overdubs. So I remember getting quite excited talking to Henry in my interviews about the next day sessions, and he couldn't give me anything because it was like he came in way after and just like played in a room on his own on top of this music that had already been constructed. Okay. So he's just replacing Bowie's demo piano parts that he'd recorded at home. So he wasn't like in the room in any meaningful way. But he did add piano overdubs to this track, but I think more flamboyantly, artistically, to God Loves the Girl. Is it God Bless the Girl? Sorry,
God Bless the Girl.
Name of it wrong. Right. God Bless. Really good piano playing on that sort of gospel, you know, underground type vibe on that, which I really like. And The Informer as well. And You Feel So Lonely as well.
Yes.
That. So he did a blinder on this album. Really good. And then, of course, that relationship, I guess, was so effective and satisfactory that Bowie felt he could trust him to be the musical director for Lazarus. And, of course, that role is more than it says on the tin, because he actually had to work with Bowie very closely to do these rearrangements, these creative reimaginings of the songs. And, of course, that was working completely in simpatico with David's. You know, they would spend hours after the Black Star sessions. You'd go to Henry Hayes' apartment in the East Village and spend hours just working on, you know, the kind of pantomime stagey version of Love Is Lost or whatever he was working on, that, you know, that sad version of Heroes.
Yeah, so he would literally go for the next day too. He was working more or less office hours in the studios, wasn't he? He was coming in the mornings, then leaving the evenings. So during the recording of Black Star, so then he would go to Henry's place and then, you know, switch heads and work on Lazarus.
Yeah. Wow. And it just makes me laugh thinking about, you know, that, particularly like, you know, that Bob Fosse cha-cha changes the sort of the version that exists on Lazarus. It just makes me laugh that they're, you know, they're bonding over making a cheesy version of Changes for their musical. But those arrangements, you know, he worked really hard on them. And actually, I was talking to someone else about this the other day, but there are bits in that workflow that kind of allude to David's awareness of music theory and, you know, what harmony does and what transposition does and, you know, where the bass note sits in a chord. These were all conversations that Henry Hay and David were having in their arranging. So, you know, when people, you know, say to me about my books, you know, is Bowie really aware of all the things he's doing in his music? I'm like, yes, I think he is. Because he's a composer of songs for 50 years. He knew his shit. But it was really gratifying to hear Henry talk about those details as well.
I can imagine. It was really lovely. And what a start to their relationship, this particular song, Where Are We Now? Yeah.
Right. You know, and chords in it are just delicious, just to die for. This is what you can tell Bowie wrote this at the piano. It's got that flavor to it, those lovely dark pastel chord changes that he does so well. Yeah, beautifully dreamy with just a hint of darkness and murkiness. Like that's how he does it.
And we touched on this earlier, but it's one of the very few tracks, I can't think of many others or any others, that seems so personal, so rooted in his personal experience and specific about that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, probably. I also get this sense that he invites that speculation, but there's a wink in it. It's like when you think about Border of Suburbia and you listen to that and you go, oh, yeah, you know, Bowie was from Bromley and, oh, he's singing about all that suburban longing.
Yeah.
But he's like, yes and no, because it's actually a book by Hennef Qureshi, you know. And I feel like this as well, there's this, you know, it makes him sound like he's pining for a time and a place. And, yeah, he is constructing that feeling. But also, you know, the fact that the pronunciations are slightly off and, you know, there's these like just little details that are a bit of a wink of, you know, this is a construction. This is theatre. You know, I am David Bowie after all. You can't get that close to me.
The video definitely does. I was going to say in the video he spells Potsdamer, that's wrong. And I remember when this came out I was in Berlin and talking to people, and many Berliners picked up on this immediately. He spelled Potsdamer Platz wrong. How could he do that? It's such, it's not as a minor side street, it's a major place. It would be like spelling, I don't know, like Oxford Circus wrong or something. So yeah. I think that that's a deliberate act. Someone as fastidious as Bowie would not allow that to go through unchecked. So I think that's absolutely underlining what you're saying here, is that these little clues, these little indicators show us that there is that veil yet to be penetrated between us, that there isn't everything out there. I can't give everything away, indeed.
Yeah. I mean, I keep coming up against this sort of feeling as well, you know, anywhere where you think it's obvious, it's almost like Bowie goes out of his way to make it not obvious and to confuse you. I'm just thinking about, like, with, you know, with the Black Star video, and there's those obvious, you know, Quaker Shaker voodoo movements. And he's like, oh, no, that's Popeye, that is. You're like, oh, okay. you know, sure. Or, you know, the fact that he sort of, you know, has a 14-year-old girl in Lazarus that he has to say goodbye to before he dies. I mean, and you think, okay. All right. God. But then, you know, he'll sort of go out of his way and say, well, but it's not autobiographical. But yet, you know, the decisions he makes, what he's wanting to do is to deliberately blur the reality and the fiction together and make it complicated and make it interesting.
And I think when you've created this character, David Bowie, as David Jones, you know, you can't play fast and loose with the history, with the mythology. Here we are discussing the history of David Bowie, you know, this construct who's as real as Ziggy Stardust, you know.
So. And you also get a sense of this game that we're talking about, this sort of playing fast and loose with David Bowie's, you know, storyline. You certainly feel that there's a couple of other songs on this album that do that, that were the B-sides like Rocket Man and things like that, where you just know he's just sort of, you know, having a little giggle to himself about playing with all these connections and all of these intersecting stories that are true and not, and then having the song just be about not, you know, anything to do with Ziggy or Elton John at all. It's about cocaine or whatever, you know. It's like, yeah, all of that stuff, I think, is one of the threads through the next day is definitely him just playing with these materials and seeing what happens.
And that was Leah Cardos on The Next Day, and many thanks to her for her insights and reflections on this album. And as you can tell, we've got as far as, gosh, I don't think we've actually got to the end of side one in Old Money, but obviously we have loads more to come. So if you enjoyed this conversation, please do rate, review and share this episode, and let me know what you think. Meanwhile, I'm going to get editing and do my best to get the next part of The Next Day out to you as soon as I can. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you can join me again very soon for part two. Thanks, and bye for now.